Welcome aboard. I'm Mendel, this is Water Bodies, and we've got a very special episode for you. We're joined by a pair of guests, one of whom was at the center of one of the biggest success stories in urban marine restoration, and the other has perhaps the deepest insight into the state of False Creek today. Today's anchor, Zeta Schneider, is sitting down with Shelley Luce and Stephen Petkow to discuss the most pressing issues facing False Creek and how we might navigate them. Shelley Luce is currently the campaigns director for Sierra Club BC and was formerly the president and CEO of Heal the Bay, an organization whose work continues to transform the ecology of the Santa Monica Bay, just outside the city of Los Angeles. Stephen Petkow is the co-owner and operator of Skookum Yacht Services, and due in part to his work retrieving derelict vessels, like the one behind me, has clocked more time under the surface of False Creek than probably anyone else. So today, we're diving down to the seabed. Let's take the plunge.
Have speed. Anyway, who are you guys? Could you introduce yourselves? Mm-hmm. I know you both.
I'm Shelley Luce. I'm the campaigns director at Sierra Club BC. And I'm really interested in the condition of False Creek today and even more interested in what False Creek could be like in the future.
And just tell Stephen what your background is, what makes, you know, what's brought you to False Creek.
I am a biologist, and focus has been on aquatic biology, a lot of stream biology, actually, originally. And in Los Angeles, I lived there for a number of years, and I worked for a couple of different organizations whose focus was ocean health, coastal marine health. And so we were able to do a lot of work on that. But also, as you know, part of the solution to a polluted ocean is what's running off the land. So we were able to do a lot of watershed work as well. And I have a lot of passion for that, which is why I think it's really interesting when you're talking, Zeta, about how to deal with the combined sewer problem that we have here and just so many different things. What's brought me to False Creek was actually Zeta started working with Sierra Club BC through our Mother Tree program. And when I finally met someone who knew about and cared about False Creek, because I hadn't really met anybody who was passionate about this little water body here, I was really, really, I felt really hopeful about the idea that we could do something here really good.
You've left the best part out. You didn't tell Stephen that you were the CEO of Heal the Bay.
Yes, that was one of the groups that I worked with in Los Angeles was Heal the Bay. And I actually started there. It was my first job in Los Angeles as a staff scientist. And then I went away and worked for a couple other groups. And then I had the enormous privilege to come back to Heal the Bay as the CEO. And that's where I think Zeta has read a little bit about what Heal the Bay was accomplishing.
That reminds me, the Wikipedia article on Heal the Bay still describes you as the CEO of it.
We've got to change that because they have a fabulous new CEO who's really doing a great job.
Stephen, share who you are with Shelley.
My brother and I came to boat repair because we dropped out of everything else. It's a terribly forgiving environment. My brother's a passionate sailor. I've been a commercial diver since 1989. We both got stuck in Vancouver after the houses got too expensive to buy. So we had to make a living at some kind of blue-collar job. I'm actually putting things in the wrong order. We both like being here. We run a boat repair shop in the Granville Island Boatyard, and we have since for about 25 years now. And Jonathan's an excellent shipwright and sailing instructor. And I've been a commercial diver, as I said, for a long time. So we've, over the last 25 years, just expanded our range of services from just sort of fixing boats to doing all kinds of dive work and salvage work. And it's because I think we lobbied the city maybe 8 or 9 years ago through our friend Jerry Dobrovolny over there, who was the head of engineering at the time.
And now is the CEO
CAO
of, CAO
of Metro Van. We told Jerry that we had some insight into where, why fecal coliform counts were so high in False Creek, because I don't think it's what people think it is a lot of the time, frankly. And we said, you know, but just to sort of raise the profile of that issue in particular, we should be doing what they do in the States, which is fund a free mobile pump out service. He thought that was a great idea. He put us onto someone in environmental services, and she did a little research, and then to our eternal surprise and astonishment, put out texted me and said, I'm publishing an RFEOI tomorrow. You should get a hold of it. And we got that contract. And then sometime during the pandemic, we lost a couple of members of our boatyard staff, and a little opportunity came up to buy a little tugboat and some salvage gear, and we did that. And since then, we've removed about 80 or 90 derelict or abandoned or sunk or hazardous vessels from the waterway.
80 or 90?
I think we're at just over 80 now.
That's a lot.
Since 2021. Over what, the majority of those have been for Transport Canada. I think we just did like job 51 or 52 for Natalie.
So Transport Canada, Shelley, is the government organization that is basically responsible for these derelict vessels through the Wrecked, Abandoned, and Hazardous Vessels Act.
Yeah, they're responsible for dealing with them. They're not responsible for them. We're all responsible for them. If they're not, if they're a sort of immediate hazard to life, limb, or the environment, it's a Coast Guard problem. But most of them aren't particularly hazardous, frankly. They're just eyesores, and they are TC problems. And their process for, if I can editorialize, their process, because we'll talk about everybody else, but the TC process for dealing with these boats
is— Transport Canada.
Transport Canada, TC.
Got it.
Is remarkably clean and fast and efficient. Like, it's a model of how these things should be. You put a good manager in the field, somebody who's got a boating background, understands not just the boats, but the waterway, the rules of the waterway, and the people on the boats, because that's important. You know, she just texted me when I was on my way over here. There's a guy out in English Bay. He found a San Juan 24 floating in, you know, in front of Kitts Beach, and had been there for a year or two. Anyway, so he goes over there in his dinghy one day and picks it up, tows it over, and rafts it onto his 40-foot sailboat, and then fills it with garbage because he's living on his own 40-foot boat and he's producing garbage, but there's no garbage truck to take his garbage away.
You pick up poop, but you don't pick up garbage.
Yeah, correct. So he just fills the San Juan with garbage until the San Juan sinks. And the mast is proud of the water by 3 or 4 feet. It's got a little Coast Guard buoy on it. And he phones me. The guy just called me because the Coast Guard's got him. They know who he is. There he is. He's right there, sank right in front of the Coast Guard station. He phones me up. Are you the guy that does the salvations? He says to me. I'm like, oh.
That's us.
All day, every day, my son. Yeah. And because they had him dead to rights, they wanted him to pay us to lift it and dispose of it. He actually asked me, if we could lift it, I have $2,000. Maybe you can just bring it up and tow it to the Vanier Park, leave it there, and the city will take care of it. And I'm like, no, they won't. You can't just dump your garbage in city property. Like, you. So how much to deal with the whole thing? I said, about $10,000, right?
Wow.
Yeah, and then his head spun off, and because he's living on a boat because—
It's expensive here to live on the beach.
As a young Ukrainian soldier who worked for us last year said, everything in Vancouver. Are you from Vancouver?
No.
Word to the wise. Everything here is expensive except the drugs. That is a horrifying and true story. That is the nicest summation of where we're at. Right? You're going to get if you're working poor or you don't have any job or you don't have any money, you don't have a place, it's a kick in the face every day. Then the consolation is meth and fent.
Cheap
and
drugs.
That stuff's cheap.
Wow.
Yeah. So he's living in a boat and he's not okay. He's really profoundly not okay. And he sure as hell can't afford $10,000. And I may be outing Natalie somewhat in saying what I'm about to say, but her pragmatism and just kind of heads up smarts about this is noteworthy. You know, she knows very well she can pay us to remove it. And that process is clean as a whistle. If it's under 10,000 bucks, like just under, she sends me the order. I respond. She says, go. I talk to the boatyard. I call the demo people. We got to get the dive crew. We blow the boat up, tow it in, recycle everything we can, throw the rest into the landfill, into a bin that goes off to the landfill. I take a bunch of pictures of the whole project, and she calls me the next day with a credit card number to pay for it. Like, it's crazy fast. Mm-hmm. If they're small boats and they're under $10,000, click, boom. And she knows that she has every right. It's she's got him, and she's got a social insurance number that should be a debt to the crown. But she knows that pursuing that guy is going to cost the taxpayer a lot more than just disposing of the boat. So she says to him, "Listen, I'm giving you this one,
right?
But now I know who you are."
It's preventative as well.
It is.
He knows that he can't keep doing
it. It is. That's right. And that doesn't always work, because some of them are truly off their nut and they're like born scofflaws to this. But
is there anything familiar in the Los Angeles environment, marine environment, that matches what Stephen has told us?
I have no familiarity with that kind of thing in Los Angeles.
What were the?
I was never working with that.
Yeah. So abandoned boats have not been an issue in Southern California, as far
well,
as
I would never make that blanket statement, but it's not something that was on my radar that we were working on at all.
What were your issues?
In Santa Monica Bay, the big issues were runoff, contaminated runoff. And what we have there is a separated system. So our storm sewers, our storm drains and sanitary sewers do not mix, which is kind of a blessing. The sanitary sewers go straight to the treatment plant, and runoff from the streets goes straight to the ocean. So it's a mixed blessing, because in a huge urban environment like that, when it rains, and in Los Angeles, you have a long dry spell, months and months and months, followed by a big rain. So that first flush is really dirty. So trash and human contaminants, bacteria, et cetera.
Melted houses.
Lately, fire debris was the big one. Yeah. If you do look at like Ahilda Bay's Instagram, for example, it's all fire debris for the last few months, which has been really important. But even without that, just cleaning up stormwater. And so there have been a bunch of ways to deal with that. And that's a lot of what we were working on. And that was a lot of bringing government agencies together to say, you can put in this money. There's this bond funding over here. You've got this source, like you were saying, about Transport Canada. So getting people together and getting them to be willing to spend the money on this kind of work was a lot of what I did for a number of years in Los Angeles. And so stormwater was a big issue. And then also habitat protection, really, because of development, because of seawalls, because of these very interesting and beautiful seasonal lagoons that are a natural habitat around Santa Monica Bay, which is where I was working. And they're so impacted over many years by development and reducing flows in the streams and things like that. So there's a lot of work on that.
Could you draw us a picture? I know what those look like, having grown up in Southern California, but could you draw us a picture of those lagoons? Because what I understand, they move around and they're shaped by the waves and weather. I just like, you know, to get a picture of what those are like and what they do.
Well, before European settlement, let's say, those lagoons would change throughout the season, as you said. So I'll use Malibu Lagoon as an example. It's about, I think, 140 square mile watershed coming down into this lovely lagoon system. But that creek would dry up quite a lot during the summer. So in the summer, there'd be just a low flow. And as a result, the sandbar would build up. And the lagoon would be closed during the summer from the ocean.
But it would trap water behind
there
it.
Would be, the lagoon would be separated from the ocean by a sandbar. It would still have some inflow from the creek. And in that lagoon, you'd have all sorts of wonderful wildlife. And then with the first rainfall, that surge of water would blow through the sandbar. And then for the rest of the winter, with the rains and everything, it would be open to the ocean. And so that system supported anadromous fish like this southern steelhead trout, which is endangered, also mullet and just all kinds of wonderful ocean life. And then when it got developed, as it developed slowly over time, we filled in that most of that wetlandy lagoon area. And so it became a remnant with houses all around it and a bridge that narrowed the creek and then upstream a dam that was privately built by people to by one family to water their livestock. And then even further upstream, a sewage treatment plant, which then discharged year round, which changed the hydrology was just so crazy. But I want the one, I'm happy you asked about this one because I do use this as an example of a good story, a good process. I wish it had happened faster, but even though it happened slowly, it was a good process in which people recognized this, the damage that had been done to this lagoon system. There are a couple of laws in the U.S. that we could use to lever action. One is the Endangered Species Act, because the Southern California steelhead trout is an endangered species. So we were able over time to have a bunch of research done that showed the historical ecology of the lagoon, what was there before, based on old hand-drawn USGS maps, and how it changed over time, and what we could do. So they ended up with this guide that was like the 10 most important things we could do for the steelhead trout and other species there. And then we did three of them, and they were pretty big. One was change the flows from the sewage treatment plant so that we had low flows in the summer and high flows in the winter, like we're supposed to have. And another one was fix the lagoon, make it bigger, change the configuration, take out some of the fills so that we get better flushing, that kind of thing. And when we were able to do these things, we saw so much life come back to the lagoon. So it was like a long process. The final restoration of the lagoon cost probably $10 million. This was back in 2013. I know it would probably be $100 million today, but at the time it was pretty expensive and it was a really big deal. But just the story of going from enormous concern to scientists doing the studies to, I didn't mention the large public process to design the new lagoon and where should we have walkways and where should we have signs and where should we have shade structures. It was all very, very important, carried out over time and then resulting in a restoration project that I think is pretty exciting and very, very gratifying.
Of course, I am just dissolving in envy when I hear about that because it feels like government wasn't necessarily completely, disassociated from what could be done.
Correct. That's right. It was mostly government funding for
and
all of that.
And you probably had also some, sporting organizations or anglers associations and things
like the Audubon Society. Right. Folks were really interested in it. And the Cal Trout, it's called. Yes, they're a group that supports wild trout populations. Yeah, you're right.
Lots what of a groups. Difference!
Was educators that were interested.
Municipal money or state money?
It was almost entirely state money.
Yeah, I want to get back to this in a bit because this is such a different kind of environment here, and I'd like to pick your brain on what you see here. But I want to ask you, Stephen. You see more of what's under the water probably than any other person around and have done so for many, many years. What's down there?
Garbage.
Is there any life down there?
There's some. There's more now than there was 20 years ago.
So it's been a dumping ground, not just for sewage, but for what, industrial cast-offs that were no longer
boat parts,
batteries. What have you seen down there?
You can kind of tell where you are in False Creek by the garbage that's on the bottom. Like, for instance, if you're on one of the docks on Granville Island where people install electronics, there's a million cable ties that are closed and then snapped open to remove bundles of wire.
And somebody just chucks it overboard.
Right. There's a lot of batteries on a bunch of, like golf cart batteries, because they're very heavy to take down the ramp and drag into the boat. And then at the end of the day, who wants to drag another 360 pounds of batteries back up the ramp? Tide's low.
That's really interesting because I always think of marine pollution along the coastline coming from the land, litter getting washed into the ocean. But you're talking about actual dumping directly.
From marinas. There's a lot of boat debris at the marinas. When we installed the nav markers and their anchors, the little channel markers out here. Each one of these little spar buoys is on a 2,000-pound block of concrete. They're littered with anchors and bicycles and
e-bikes.
Yeah. It's a lot of bikes.
But what about all the stuff from the 150 years of industry when there was when they used to dump like the tailings from the sawmills, the bark and all that just went in the water? Is any of that still there?
I haven't seen that. I've seen some big industrial equipment. You know, there's a couple of old boilers and parts of large machinery, clearly ancient stuff near Science World. There's some stuff like that near Quayside and over there in Charleston. No, most of it's fairly recent. It looks to me, you know. There are sea pens and anemones, and every now and then we'll see a stray ratfish ghosting into False Creek, and the dogfish will come.
But you say you see changes.
I mean, that's certainly anecdotally from the community. They're like, if your bottom paint dies, you get more growth on your boat faster than you did 20, 30 years ago. I don't think there's any, nobody really doubts that anymore.
I mean, like if you had the luxury of having governments like the state of California operating here, what would you do?
I would stop fretting about feces, frankly.
The prospect of making False Creek swimmable, you think that's...
I swim in it all the time. I was in a wetsuit for 2.5 hours today. I didn't bathe afterwards.
Have you ever been sick?
Never.
Never.
I'm covered in cuts from boatyard work. And in this time of year, we clean a lot of running gear, right? I kill a lot of barnacles and mussels that are on boat parts, and we send them down to feed thousands upon thousands of crabs. And our hands are just cut raw, like often bleeding in the water while we're working. And I've never had a localized infection. I've never, when people say they get sick from the water,
So you think that our focus on E. coli
give it up. The city's going to do what they're going to do. They're going to separate the sewers. It's going to take a long time. The CSOs are really active. And
define CSO, please.
That's a combined sewer outfall.
What are those?
That's the combined system that we're talking about. In times of heavy rainfall, the storm system is overcome, and as I understand it, and backflows into the sewage. Well, it's not just sewage. It's all household and it's all domestic and industrial water from the land, from land-based facilities, right? So if it's coming from your house, it's 90% gray water and maybe 10% black water. I think, I don't really know. I mean, the sun
more gray than black because you got showers, washing machines, dishwashers.
Yeah, yeah.
Those are gray because they don't have sewage in them. And then there's toilets are black.
Yeah. The sump in my 120-year-old house backed up 2 weeks ago. And then we had a 2-meter patch in the basement and I saw that water and my wife was shocked about how comfortable I was working around it. I'm like, this is
not
nothing. I got this. It's okay. The city's going to do what they're going to do. Boaters are getting better. When we started running the service, we were really optimistic that we would get a whole bunch of boaters
This is the pump out service.
When we started running the pump out service, we were optimistic that there's a whole bunch of boaters that we know of who are dumping overboard all the time. And they never call us. They
still don't.
They still
Even
don't.
It's free.
And they're not going to. It's free. Like, nobody tells Grumpy John Timmerman what to do, ever.
Not to mention any names.
You can edit that out if you want. Or you can go over and talk to him and you'll know why he's never going to.
So we should stop fretting about.
Yeah, there's lots of
pollution.
Other really bad things that are going on. Like, there are dozens upon dozens of street level drainages into False Creek. Mm-hmm. And I've spoken to engineers about them. And in fact, one of the young people, we always try to hire nice young people to run the pump out service. Mm-hmm. The first year, we hired grumpy old people, sailors, mariners, and stuff. bad PR. The boaters don't like people. Now we hire nice young people from the Prince of Wales Mini School. That was where my daughter was going to school. And then it was like the aunt's social kids from UBC, mm-hmm. and a really nice young kid from getting an environmental engineering degree. And he worked for us. Colin did, ran the service for a couple of summers, and then took a summer as an engineer in training with the City of Vancouver. And said, yeah, they just don't, there's no map of these street level drainages. A lot of them were installed, when you mentioned the private dam, I thought about these, you know, like 80, 90 years
people
ago.
Just built them.
Yeah, yeah, just build it. If you're 80, 90 years ago, you're building a house over here, an apartment building over there.
Just do your own connect.
Yeah, just exactly. We got to get rid of this stuff somewhere. Let's just lay a culvert
in
here.
And it's drainage from their from different properties. It's not
all over
sewage.
The place. It's not sewage. It's And the CSOs are all subtidal,
yes.
and they're large, like it's
big pipes.
Yeah, yeah, like square, and it's like looks like a garage. Like I've gone into them. It's mm-hmm. it's kind of fun, but these things are culverts, you know, 2-3 feet across, and they're in the intertidal zone, mm-hmm. and they're the CSOs really only disgorge waste. And let's be clear, right? It's mostly stormwater. Mm-hmm. It's mixed
road runoff
and
too.
Road runoff. And that's right. And it's mixed with domestic and
waste.
It's waste water. That's only maybe 5-10% black water. Mm-hmm. So now it's even more diluted, and it's coming into False Creek during heavy rain events, which is not what happened yesterday. That was not a heavy rain event. Like a heavy rain event is in November, December, January, February, when we get 40, 50 millimeters of rain in a 24-hour period. And you can see it. Like you can go there.
Yeah, it makes a plume.
I have fantastic videos of the water just like the sea level's like an inch higher over top of the CSO than it is everywhere else. Wow. And the gulls are all over it because there's tasty.
They love it.
Right, they love it. And you can feel it, it's warmer. Mm. Yes, I put my hand in it. And we took E. coli, we did samples with the, who was that?
Swim drink fish
people. Yep. They had a little E. coli sampling lab. We sampled the water. And what do you know? It's really high. We went back the next day, you know, after the rain stopped, and it was like vanishingly small.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because the water's so cold. I don't think it's a particularly fertile environment. Mm-hmm. So. I'm not a biologist. I don't really know.
I want to turn the corner now. We've got a sense of what's going on here. We'll come back to the idea of your idea for a harbor master of one agency responsible for False Creek.
Yeah.
We've heard from you about the fact that, you know, you could do really important restoration work and sustainability work. You've both seen your respective environments, and I'm hoping that the two of you can share a bit about what you think could happen here based on your experience. And I'd like to hear from you, Shelley. What have you seen here? What would you do if you were the CEO of False Creek Friends? And that's an invitation,
by
the way.
Oh, thank you. I see nothing but potential here. And I think it's really interesting that Stephen just said, stop focusing on the combined sewer overflows and think about the street runoff, the street level input from runoff. Because as I mentioned, one of the things I've dealt with the most is exactly that, because we didn't have the combined sewer. It was just runoff. However, we did focus a lot on bacteria because people cared so much about it. Now, these are heavily used beaches where I'm talking about in Los Angeles, so maybe that's a major difference. It's also so relatable. We all know that bacteria makes you sick or viruses make you sick. So it was an extremely valuable tool to get people interested and engaged and showing up and writing letters and speaking loudly to their electeds in different agencies and whatever, to bring attention and to make sure that action was taken. That's why people cared about the pump outs in the marinas, but even that was a subset. What most people cared about was what was happening at the beach. Different here in BC, maybe for the specific ecosystem, but so much care and concern for the environment here. And I feel that, I'll tell you my sadness learning a lot about BC is that there is a disconnect between what people see and feel about BC's natural environment and what's actually happening. And for me, that's mostly most clear in forestry because we love our forests so much. And we think that back in the 80s when we all protested the Clayoquot Sound clear cutting, and then recently when people protested Ferry Creek, we were like, okay, we stopped the clear cutting, but we didn't. There's so much clear cutting all over BC. Well, I feel that that applies to water as well in many ways. So we have this incredible Burrard Inlet. We have an incredible arm that goes north from there. We have incredible False Creek here. And while people value them, I feel like they don't understand what they were and therefore what they could be again. Not that we would ever be able to go back 100 years, 200 years to exactly what was there, but as far as a level of health and a level of ecosystem thriving that I believe is attainable here in Burrard Inlet and in False Creek, that's what I would like people to understand. One of the things that hooked me on this work is the historical ecology that I mentioned, because it really paints a picture of what was here, and you feel the loss. When you look at what some sailor or somebody drew and filed with the government back in 1850 or something, and you see, what are all these little marks? That's all eelgrass? That was all eelgrass? Then you kind of feel, you're standing there looking at what it is now, it's concrete or something, and you realize we lost something. We lost something really amazing. And then you want to bring it back. And I just feel like if we were able to help people understand the changes that this area has gone through and what's possible here now, that would be really valuable.
How would you do that? What would you do? What would be your first thing that you would do in False Creek?
I would get hold of that historical stuff, which I know the False Creek Friends Society already has, and I would try to share that in any way I could. If you want to get detailed, I'd say let's start with local papers. Let's start getting some of this stuff put out there. Let's get a little article on it. I don't know how to start, who to contact necessarily, but there are ways to do that. You started it with World Ocean Day this year, and that was your first time. In my experience, every event takes a year or two, so your next time will be bigger and bigger, and more people will learn about it. And then the next thing I would do as far as what is possible here is getting people like you together and the people that you have on your advisory board and start drawing that. Like, we know where False Creek was connected to Burrard Inlet at this eastern end, right?
It was just right across over here, just about where Carroll Street runs in right now. There was actually, downtown was an island at that point.
So, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah. So it's actually really interesting in terms of the hydrodynamics. I'll just share this with a bit. When we have sometimes about 17 feet of tide, so, and that happens twice a day in False Creek. So it used to be that the tide would come in from this way, and then when it started to ebb, it would go out that way. Now it just backs up because there's no way for it to get out. And so at the eastern end of False Creek, the tide's just going up and down. There's no current. There's no way of bringing in all the fresh nutrients from, you know, English Bay and the Salish Sea.
Well, the Inner Harbor, where the water tastes different and is significantly colder.
Yeah, you can feel that when
there are different animals growing in the Inner Harbor than here. Like, there are tube worms all over everything in the Inner Harbor. None here. It's kind of interesting.
And there's a lot of interest. I've seen a couple of articles lately, actually, about buried streams in Vancouver. That's true all over North America. I dealt with the same thing. Daylighting streams or portion of streams or even recreating where there was one before, that could happen here in False Creek. And then we have water that's being naturally filtered through soils and rocks before it reaches the water. That's what I get excited about when I hear you talking about these street level drainages. They don't have to be pipes.
No.
They could be something more natural.
This is the green, the GRI technology, the green water infrastructure.
Green infrastructure.
So the difference I'm also hearing is like a political difference between Southern California and British Columbia. And you want to say
Stan Persky.
I remember Stan.
Rest his soul. Died last year. Stan said to me once, I don't know how you can't walk around. Like, it's everything's so new here. He says, everywhere I walk around in Vancouver, I think about what this place looked like in the time of my parents and grandparents.
Not that long
ago. Never mind 5 or 10,000 years ago. But yeah, there are First Nations people who will tell you that their family shot or hunted elk, for heaven's sake, mm-hmm. in what's now Vanier Park. But the reason, like, I mean, 21st century capitalism makes everyone an amnesiac dolt anyway, but it's especially true here, I think, because people... There's two reasons people come to Vancouver, basically. Reason one is to make a lot of money in a big hurry, right? You raid the forest, you raid the mountains of its minerals, and then when that's all gone, you speculate on the land. And the other group of people who come here are the people who are just besotted with
the beauty
of the place. And I'm, this is going to sound really cynical, but... neither of those groups of people are especially great at critical analysis and historical thought. So it's a big stone to get Vancouverites to think about their history. But I just want to say, to second what you're like, I want people to walk around like Stan, imagining like
what it was like.
Because when Stan moved here in the whenever 70s. He was fascinated with the place and the history because he's just, he's a fascinated and fascinating guy. So he's just, and a lifetime self-educator. So he just read about it and it's interesting. I don't know how to, I mean, I regard the body of water and the city largely as a benighted place I can't wait to get the hell away from, except I can't because it is still fascinating for these historical reasons. And but I don't know how to get human beings interested in the history of the place because nobody came here for the history. They came here to obliterate it.
And they were not invited. And I'm just wondering about the role of traditional knowledge in current environmental restoration efforts.
We are so incredibly fortunate that the people who stewarded this land for many thousands of years are still here today stewarding and sharing knowledge. So I think when I talk about historical ecology and maps drawn by sailors who arrived, that's what I had access to in Los Angeles. Yeah. Here we have access to real people and entire communities who remember and who have been told directly by the folks who were here at that time what it was like. And so that's the most precious resource, I think, we have.
Yeah, I think I could not agree more. Yeah.
So how is that being incorporated into restoration work? I don't know right now, actually. I'm not directly involved in a restoration project around Vancouver area. I know there are several going on. I live in North Vancouver, and there's been some amazing work on the creeks, like... McKay Creek and Mosquito Creek, restoring salmon habitat. And I know that the Squamish Nation participated. I also know that the Tsleil-Waututh Nation is doing incredible work right now in Burrard Inlet on intertidal and streams. So I think we're really lucky that that's going on. And I think we all need to learn from that. I certainly would love to be able to learn from that.
And what about in terms of political engagement and its relationship to getting the citizenry connected to this, because it is a slog. It really is. It feels sometimes like hand-to-hand combat to just get in front of some person and say, did you know that there is a place in False Creek that its original Coast Salish name was place where young person committed suicide. There was a place that obviously was touched people at the time because it must have been so incredibly rare that would happen, that it changed the relationship. Now, that's a baleful example, but how do we connect people with this sense of attachment in that they have a sense of desire to do what you two do, which is, I've used this kind of term, custodianship or stewardship. What is it that will entice people to want to be part of that stewardship activity?
Don't you think it has to do with firsthand experience?
Yep.
We agree. Uh-huh.
That's the whole story.
That's the whole story.
Get them on the water.
Get them in gumboots.
Get them in gumboots. Pick up a shovel. You know, people like work. They say they don't. They want to give it to the robots.
Beach cleanups.
I don't know anybody happier than a human being who's done good work at the end of the day. Like,
so yeah. That you think is...
We've structured the whole global economy to avoid manual labor. But I'm telling you, it makes you feel really good.
Do it.
Look how happy I am.
It's true, though. I agree.
You have
to feel the water. And I think something Hilda Bay has done so well, and many other groups as well, including groups here, Oceanwise and others, are beach cleanups you just mentioned. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you the number of people who I've seen the light go on, because they're like, oh, they pick up a few big pieces of trash and like, that's it. And then they look closer and they realize that there's all these tiny little pieces of plastic. And then they think, plastic, and then they get all enlightened to what plastic is doing to our planet, and they want so much to do things differently.
I was working with a group of visiting scholars from Singapore, young students who were taking a course at UBC, and they told me that the Singaporean government offered, if you were to go out and rent a kayak and you were a tourist and you wanted to rent a kayak, if you picked up garbage and you brought it back, the Singapore government would give you money to pay for the kayak rental. Great. I mean, it just seems like such a brilliant idea of actually engaging sort of in two things. You mentioned how the meaning that people get, but to be able to enjoy the water and the brilliant environment and to clean it up, mm-hmm. boy, that's pretty powerful.
Mm-hmm. No, and manual labor is cheap. I know, because no one's paying me very well.
Oh, poor guy. Poor guy.
But what do you think? How do you envision getting people engaged with False Creek particularly?
I mean, I've tried so many different things. we to just confirm what Stephen said, we work with Hakai Institute on its Sentinels of Change project. And basically what we do is we collect data on the larval Dungeness crab. We are one of 40 community groups up and down the coast from the Haida Gwaii to Puget Sound. We all have exactly the same equipment, and it's deployed at exactly the same time, and then we just do sampling of what the Dungeness crab larvae is doing. People love that project because they know that they're producing data for the scientists. The scientists will analyze that, and they'll give us answers back about potentially what needs to be done, and that closes this virtuous circle. It's not just like taking out the recycling or liking something on your Instagram account. They know that it will produce value, and that is what is really meaningful for people. That is developing the sense of place and this sense of relationship to it.
Yeah.
And that reminds me, we call this podcast Water Bodies, and we ask our guests to share a water body that made an impact on them, maybe the first one where that you might have developed this relationship with a particular water body. Stephen, what was your water body and why?
I'm underslept and exhausted, so I may just break down in tears. I grew up on the prairies for the first 7 years of my life. I had on the wall of my bedroom the National Geo poster of the cetaceans of the world. And I just remember devouring the article. I couldn't have been seven. We were in Winnipeg, so I was six. I think when we moved to Mississauga, I was seven, eight, and we took a road trip. And we went to Peggy's Cove.
Peggy's Cove in Nova Scotia.
And it was really the first time I'd seen it. And I sat down on a rock and hugged my knees, and they couldn't pull me away from it. The dynamism of it, and its obvious, like, scale and scope and energy were just, like, just enthralling.
That was life-changing.
Yeah. And I've been an ocean person ever since.
Shelley.
It's hard to say the first one, but one that comes to mind for me is in the neighborhood where I grew up when I was quite little, there was a pond. The neighborhood was called Pond Mills. And I remember being fascinated by loving that pond, especially in the summertime. And it was grassy along the edge and I could see tadpoles and stuff. But then what amazed me the first time I realized it was in the winter when my parents would shovel the pond so that we could skate on it. And I could see through the ice and I realized it was still water. And I could see the grass through the ice. And then it blew my mind. Mm-hmm. And then all I wanted was water after that. So in university, I did anything water that I could, and I just kept doing it. And whether it was freshwater or ocean, you can't tear me away from a waterfall. I love a big wave in the ocean.
And remind me again what you got your PhD in?
Environmental science, but with a pretty strong focus on water, I will say.
See, it is life-changing, right? I mean, this identification that we do have with water is so powerful. And this ability for us to have a deeper, more profound relationship with what water is, you know, how we've instrumentalized it over the years, how we've used it, you know, to, you know, this expression, the solution to pollution is dilution. We have these very negative instrumental ideas about water, what water does for us. And hearing your experiences, Shelley in Santa Monica Bay, and you, Stephen, you know, for your diligent work, really taking care of it. You're completely bought in to making False Creek better, and I really appreciate that. Any last words to share?
I can't wait till we are pulling out concrete somewhere around False Creek here and restoring some of these little creeks that used to flow in here. And I know the city has some exciting plans for restoration, and I want to be able to support those and bring people to work on them, get their hands dirty, get in the water, and build the care and concern for False Creek.
Yeah, because we work with the city a lot. Like, we work for environmental services and the cops and parks and engineering, and I deal with them all the time. And a number of years ago, I thought it was so obvious that the place needed to be better managed, that it was really just a matter of, like, me talking to these people and they would see it.
And how has that worked out?
Shit on a stick, to be blunt. What's amazing is they all know it. This place needs better management. You're a parking engineer in training. You're here to design city streets. They've put you in charge of this place because they know so little about the marine environment and the boat traffic that all they can think is, well, there's got to be some land-based correlate. Let's get a parking person down here. You know, the city park, the parks owns the marinas. They've described the marina as a park. It's just a parking lot. It's a parking lot for boats. I'm like, no, it's a parking lot where the environment is trying to corrode it, degrade it, break it every day, all the time. And there's potable water, sewage, and fire suppression systems in the water, inside the parking lot, built in the parking lot. So no, it's profoundly different from a parking lot. But there's no maritime culture, for lack of a better word, at the city of Vancouver. And they all know it. The police know it. The engineers know it. And when you say this place needs a harbor master, they go, "Oh, I know." And I'm like, "So what? What do we got to do, guys?" and they always tell me, "Oh, it's really complicated, Stephen." And I'm like, "Enlighten me." Like, I got the time, and I'm not stupid. I mean, bit of a dumb dumb, but you can tell me. And they No.
Yeah. So that has to change.
The city lobbied the federal government in 2008, 2009 to have a memorandum of understanding with the city. Sorry, the city lobbied the federal government. They wanted a memorandum of understanding so that they could enforce the federal rules in the waterway. And they got it. But according to Jerry, took some gnashing of teeth and butting of heads, but they got it. And they're like, they're now the city's like the dog that catches cars or chases cars. It caught the car, but it doesn't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
Because they just have no maritime culture or background, like pretty close to zero. Jody Collins, who works at this marina, he's actually done more than anybody to get rid of derelict and abandoned hazardous vessels, because he's on the ground every day and he and his staff are on the water cataloging these things and feeding information to the Coast Guard and Transport Canada and the police. And because that level of civil servant that's a better collector of information than four armed dudes in uniform in a 40-foot boat. But anyway, that's an editorial comment perhaps. But, you know, Jody is the first, that's the first time that somebody with a marine background has worked at a marina. Right, and the city's hamstrung because the parks runs the marinas, has to be parks people who are the marina attendants. Parks, that's a union job, right? And the people who work at the marinas, they come here from sign painting or trimming roses in the Rose Garden at Stanley Park. Like,
there's not that maritime culture.
Where is that maritime culture? Who has that?
So I can fill you in because I've sailed up and down the coast and, you know, California down to southern Mexico. Virtually every port that I have visited in will either have a harbor master, a port captain, a park ranger. These are people, even in small little fishing villages, you come into a port, The ocean is their lives in some of these small communities. Somebody will always come out. Mm-hmm. He may be wearing a uniform or he may just be a fisherman, but they want to know about you. They want to know you actually own the boat. They want to know that you have insurance, and they want to know that you have a way of keeping your poop from going into their waters. This is something that is important to them. In many places in Washington, Oregon, and certainly in California, you go into a place and you might be boarded by a harbor master or a delegate who wants to look at your toilet. And to make, sometimes they will put a stamp on it so you cannot open the valve.
That's where they will lock close the overboard discharge through hole.
Or put a dye in your holding tank, you know, that will blossom out and, you know, and they'll seize your boat if you've discharged anything, but everybody knows the rules. And generally, harbor masters are those people who administer what those rules are. They tell you where you can anchor and for how long. And they'll tell you, you know, where are the resources, and they'll tell you when you have to be out of here, when you've—
Well, and most importantly, they're on the water all the time, and it's their livelihood. Like,
they know the place.
They know the place.
They're intimate with it, and like everybody, every civic employee in Falls Creek is a drop-in, right? A drop-in from the comment. Darren McDougall is the head of the Marine Unit. He said to me, "We're all just trying to run this off the side of our desks, right?"
So, why is it so unimportant? Is it not a revenue generator? Is it? You
know, well, it is, in fact. The civic marinas.
I would,
but
think
not,
so.
Not the itinerant vessels are not.
No.
They're free. You have to get a permit, theoretically, to anchor a boat in False Creek. You're allowed 2 weeks stay, and then you have to leave. In the wintertime, it's a little bit, it's 3 weeks. But nobody gets the permits. Well, maybe 10% of people who come in, they will get a permit.
Because there's no one checking.
Oh, no, they are checking. They check all the time.
But there's nothing that they can do with their boats. You know,
There's
no impound lot. There's, you know, they can issue what's called a direction notice and says, you know, if you're not out of here, we're going to seize your boat. But they can't seize your boat because then they're responsible for it. They have to maintain custody of it in a locked, secure facility.
That doesn't exist. I know what happens if you have a rule. You try to lay down a rule you can't enforce. You're not a parent anymore. You're a doormat. And so, and that's kind
what's
of
what's happening.
Yeah. There is money generated. There's millions of dollars in revenue generated by the civic marinas. I do work for them sometimes, and I have done work on the marinas, so I'm not unfamiliar with the budgets and the costs. And I can tell you that the money that they collect from the marinas is not going back into the marinas. I mean, some of it is, but not all of it. And they generate enough money with the marinas to better manage the waterway. I'm probably kind of dropping, like, I should also point out the city is my biggest customer, right? Like the various parts of the city. And I enjoy working for these people because all of them actually give a damn. And they phone us all the time just to find out what's going on. And they phone so often. I answer the phone. Like, I'm like a Falls Creek Harbor Master. Steven speaking.
Need a uniform.
Disappoint yourself.
They're just like laughing. They're like, yeah, okay, what's going on with that green Catalina 27 over
there? We'll get you a t-shirt printed up or something.
It's just a much larger salary than I'm making right now. And I frankly, I built a business out of nothing and I like it.
Of course.
But, yeah, they mean well. It's the city of Vancouver is strangely obtuse. Like I think they believe their own hype that they really are kind of globally special, and they seem to kind of think they need their own kind of homegrown Vancouver solutions to all of these Vancouver problems. Whereas, like, you know, lots of other cities with small inner harbors like this have aced this stuff for years, and they don't like. I don't understand. I really don't. And I think we're probably like one elected official away from just forcing this a little bit. And because I know the money's there, certainly among the citizens here, that would be a popular idea. But Transport Canada and the Coast Guard, they try to help, but they've largely been written out of it. Like,
so the city.
Yeah. And the province of British Columbia, I don't know what do they do here?
Interesting.
We could be adopted by California. Right to it.
But it's really quite
things
interesting.
Things have changed since I was in California. I almost feel bad when you're saying, well, the politics must be so as if it's better
if
there.
I'm
not saying it's better. Able to do some stuff.
Suppose we become the 51st state. Would that help?
No.
Okay.
Absolutely not.
We wouldn't be a state anyway. We'd just be a colony.
That's right. Again.
Yeah. He doesn't want us voting, Zeta. Come on. But daylighting streams is something that citizens and politicians and civil servants could get really excited about. And that may be the way to get the waterway better managed.
Yeah. And Shelley, with your experience in the lagoons, I think a way or a process of starting maybe pilot programs to rewild, soften the shorelines, get rid of all these vertical concrete surfaces. So why don't we try to do that?
Yeah. I'm in.
You'll help us do the...
I'm busy picking up the trash for a while, yeah.
Okay, well, when you've got most of it, we'll come back to you. Thank you so much. This
Thank
has
you,
been
Zeta.
A great conversation, and it will not be our last. Thank you.
Thank you.
No, thank you.
Water Bodies is a production of the False Creek Friends Society. Please help spread the word and get involved. False Creek could use your help. Subscribe to our newsletter at falsecreekfriends.org for the latest news and volunteer opportunities. And what do you want to see in False Creek? You can leave us a comment. Water Bodies is a video podcast on YouTube and Spotify and an audio podcast everywhere else. We'll see you next time.